the third principle of manifestation is called honoring your worthiness to receive. So we've talked about understanding that not only that you have a higher self, but that it is the part of you that wants to be at peace. And then the second aspect of it is to learn to trust in your divine inner wisdom, to trust it so strongly that you have banished all doubt. And now we're talking about honoring your worthiness to receive it. And the affirmation for this principle of manifestation is, I deserve to experience divine abundance, for I am a part of God. And of course, the universe is abundant. It is endless. This intelligence that I've been speaking about is endless and abundant. And you, therefore, also are abundant and are deserving of that abundance. But there's a lot of stuff that has come your way that has worked to convince you that this isn't true. And what I want to do here in this principle is to help you to recognize not only your own divinity, but that whatever comes your way, you are entitled to. And that there's nothing selfish about having a desire. This idea that somehow there's an incompatibility with desiring abundance in your life or desiring healing or desiring anything in your life. You know, you can't create without a desire. You can't have anything without a desire. Even the desire to be desireless is a desire. And this idea that we don't have desires is really almost, it's a hallucination. It's a myth that somehow I shouldn't be wanting things. You are a part of the endlessness and the abundance of this divine universe. And you are not incompatible with prosperity and joy and wealth and fulfillment. This is something that you not only can ask for, but are entitled to. And you must know that. Someone mailed this to me that I thought I'd share this with you. It's called I Am Lost. It says, a woman is dying of AIDS. A priest is summoned. He attempts to comfort her, but to no avail. I am lost, she said. I have ruined my life and every life around me. Now I'm going painfully to hell. There's no hope for me. The priest saw a framed picture of a pretty girl on the dresser. Who is this? He asked. The woman brightened. She is my daughter, the one beautiful thing in my life. And would you help her if she was in trouble or made a mistake? Would you forgive her? Would you still love her? Of course I would, cried the woman. I would do anything for her. Why do you ask such a question? Because I want you to know, said the priest, that God has a picture of you on his dresser. And I think that picturing ourselves this way, with all of the problems that we have had, the things that we feel bad about, the mistakes that we may have made, the people that we may have hurt, all of these kinds of things have a tendency to make us feel unworthy. There's a lot of people who think, you know, I'm going to be able to manifest what I want in my life as soon as I am no longer an addict, or as soon as I am no longer fat, or as soon as I remove all of these problems I have in this relationship. When I get rid of all of this, when this all goes, then I will feel worthy. And it's almost like you have to shift that consciousness around and come at it from a different perspective, which says, I love myself while I am fat. I love myself while I'm an addict. I love myself regardless of what it is that I may have seen as something that I shouldn't be, that God does have a picture of me on his dresser, is the metaphor as well. And what it does is it fills you with this kind of unconditional love that I'll be talking about a little bit later in one of the later principles. But you begin to say, yes, I am worthy. And I'll tell you when you feel most worthy of what it is that you would like to be able to manifest. You see, if you feel unworthy, what you do is you block the flow. And remember, there's an energy. There's a flowing of energy in everything. That's what manifesting is. It's and the idea that somehow I shouldn't have this or there's something wrong with it immediately puts you into a feeling or a space of being separate from this thing that you want to manifest. It's like you put up that blockage. Someone asked the question, does God have this for me? Does God want that for me? And almost always when we ask that question, we make an assumption. We're coming from that ego assumption that God and I are separate. And the same thing is true when you're feeling unworthy. What you're really saying is that God has made a mistake here. And there are no mistakes. And this divine intelligence is everywhere. And it's a theme that will run through this entire program. This idea that what I want to manifest has the same divine intelligence in it that is in me and that is in everything. So I'm realigning myself. But you can't realign yourself if you feel like what you would like to have come to you, that you aren't worthy of it. You have to know that you are as worthy of anything showing up in your life as anyone else is on the planet. The essence of this is that you have to be at peace. And being at peace is what enlightenment is. As my teacher told me, enlightenment is being immersed in and surrounded by peace. That's the definition of enlightenment. And it is also what the higher intelligence or the sacred part of you or the higher self always wants. It just wants you to be at peace. Nothing else. It's not asking anymore. When you feel unworthy, you're not at peace. The ego has taken over this idea somehow that you have certain obligations, you have to behave in certain ways, you have to fulfill the obligations of your conditioning or of the tribe. That's what starts to take over, and you've got to let go of that. I recently appeared down in Australia with one of my friends, John Gray, who wrote Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, and he's got us on different planets and all of this, and he's a wonderful guy. We had a great time down there. And I was asked to talk about relationships and to write an article. So I wrote an article that I really liked. I called it, Your Soulmate is the Person You Can't Stand. And everybody thought, wow, what kind of a crazy thing is that to say? Because most people, when they talk about they're looking for their soulmate, you know, I finally found my soulmate, and we think alike, and we act alike, and we both like green, and asparagus is our favorite vegetable, and he goes to say something, and before he can even say it, I say it already. Oh my God, we think the same thoughts, and we get up early in the morning, and we both like to meditate, and we both like yoga, and we both eat mushrooms, and we eat them the same way, and he cuts the stems off the same way I cut the stems off. It's just amazing. This is my soulmate. And I always say to those people, you got about 3 more weeks, okay, in this relationship. And this relationship is going to be over. Because this is not your soulmate, okay? I mean, who needs more of what you already are, right? That you're not looking for a mirror of yourself, if you will. Now, we have a tendency to think that. What do we share in common? All right. And then if we're in common, then I'm going to have a peaceful relationship because we're going to always think the same and act the same and so on. That isn't the way it generally works. See, the reason I say your soulmate is the person you can't stand, and I say that a bit facetiously, but what I'm saying here is that peace, being at peace, is the essence of feeling worthy. It's the essence of manifesting. It's the essence of enlightenment, being at peace. Any moment that you're at peace, you're in an enlightened state. And when people ask, is there a difference between people who are living at a higher level, self-actualizing people who are at peace, and the rest of us who are not at peace, say, no, we all have peaceful thoughts, and so do enlightened people. They have peaceful thoughts. The only difference is that they have nothing else. That's all they have. They don't have all of this other stuff that goes with it. All of the anger, all of the judgment, all of the fears, all of the anxiety, the stuff that we have come to believe is just a part of our lives. The self-reproachment, the self-repudiation. We have a tendency to think that this is normal. It's only normal. So along come people in your life who know how to push certain buttons. Okay? These people can come in many forms. They can come as in-laws. They can often come, and almost always they come as a spouse. And they can come as your children. And when these people show up in your life, they can take you away from your peace. Almost all of us have somebody in our life that we can never get rid of. You know, it's like Kevin Costner talked about in that Waterworld movie of his, you know, they're like a turd that won't flush, you know. You keep flushing, and you look at that, still there. That's a good image or not, but I always liked that image. You know? You keep trying and trying, they're back again, right? So we have these people in our lives. And these people show up, and they say something in a certain way, and it doesn't make any difference. If somebody else said it, we would just ignore it. All right? But they come along and they say this thing, and boom, off you go. And you're frantic, and you're mad, and you're angry, you're upset, you're worked up, you're feeling unworthy. So these people, to me, are your soulmates, you see. Because what they're teaching you at any given moment in your life is you haven't mastered yourself at this moment. You're not in charge of yourself. Those people who can push your buttons and send you into a frenzy or into an angry space or into a space of self-repudiation are people who are divine masters disguised as manipulative, crass, unconcerned people. And rather than being mad at them and being upset with them and saying that they shouldn't be this way, your task ought to be to turn to them and bow and say, I honor you as my teacher. Now that's a hard thing for us to get to, but don't you all have people in your life who are just like that? And you know you're stuck with them. These are people who are not on your path. You know they're not on your path. They're not even on an entrance ramp to your path. They're in a different place. They're from a different planet. But nevertheless, they're there with you. And you're sharing the journey with them. And it's very interesting. I mean, I have 8 children. And my children are the ones that are very good at knowing how to push these buttons. I have one daughter particularly, her name is Serena, that can really do this very well. She's real good at it. She's always giving me advice almost every day on how to be a better parent. She even said to me one time, she said, I can't believe you actually wrote a book on how to be a better parent. I just can't believe that. She was about 9 years old telling me this. You really wrote that? And whenever she gives me this advice, it's like, or she starts going into one of her routines, I find myself, you know, really being challenged. You know, I don't usually turn around and say, I honor you for, you know, I'm usually saying, well, yeah. But nevertheless, there's a part of me that recognizes this, and I also recognize it in my relationship with my wife. And we've been together for a long time, and there are areas where she will say something and I will find myself, and then I'll stop. You see, because essentially, the ego part of us wants us to be right, whereas the higher part of us always wants what? Peace. That's all it ever wants. So it's like you have to really learn, if you're going to feel worthy of having something show up in your life, how to be peaceful. And the way to be peaceful in your life is to, in all of your relationships, when you have a choice to be right or to be kind, to just pick kind, to just choose to be kind at any given moment in your life. You are honoring that higher part of you, you feel peaceful, and you've let go of the ego need, which says, wait a minute, you're important. And you have to prove that this other person shouldn't have done that and all of that kind of stuff. But Serena, I remember her telling me, she's great. She would tell me, giving me advice on how to be a parent. One day I just had it with her. And I said, you know, Serena, I said, it's time for you to stop telling me what kind of a parent to be and stop blaming me for the kind of parent I am and take responsibility yourself for the kind of parent that I am. And she stopped, and she assumed this pose that she always assumes with her hand on her hip, you know, and her knee going up and down real fast. And she said, you want to run that one by me one more time? You want me? Is that what I heard? You want me to be responsible for the kind of parent you are? I said, exactly. She said, well, what are you talking about? I said, well, before you came here, you had a choice. You have certain heroic missions that you have to fulfill while you're here on this planet. I'm giving her this little lecture. You know, she said, well, what do you mean before I came here? She said, I don't remember that. I said, well, your memory isn't anything that you should rely upon to determine whether this works or doesn't work. You don't remember being 4 months old and being in your crib and throwing up all over, but you did. You don't remember your dreams last night. You don't remember what you had for dinner last Thursday. Your memory isn't a good indicator of what it was. Just trust me, this is true. Before you come here, you choose your parents. You get to pick who your parents are. And you have certain lessons that you have to learn, and you picked me to be your father, and you picked mom to be your mother, and you should stop complaining about the choice that you made. She said, I don't remember any of this. I said, well, forget about whether you remember it or not. She said, you're telling me that I chose you to be my father before I came here, and I had lessons to learn through you. I said, exactly. And you should stop blaming me. You should just take responsibility for the choice you made. She said, I must have been in a big hurry. So, these are your tests, all right? I'll tell you the greatest one, though. I mean, my wife had gone away. She's working on a book herself on a spiritual approach to childbirth and infancy care. And she went away for a month, and I took over Mr. Mom for 30 days while she rented a house on Maui. We live in Florida. She was making sure she wasn't coming home on weekends, like I do. And kids, I mean, they really are your challenge. They are the real ones that challenge your worthiness to receive anything. And I was making breakfast one morning, and they were all sitting over at the table, and I was making waffles. And so I'm at the toaster in the back, and I hear, and the children are behind me. And all of a sudden, I hear my 13-year-old daughter, who is Summer, saying to my 11-year-old, Serena, she asked this question out of the blue. She said, Serena, she said, if you didn't have any feet, would you wear shoes? And I turned around and, what in the world? What kind of a question is that? And Serena looked at her and said, what do you mean if I didn't have any feet, would I wear shoes? She said, of course not. And Summer said to her, well, why are you wearing that bra? So, I'm telling you, they can be tough. So what I would like you to think about when you think about honoring your worthiness to receive anything is that all of the people in your life that you find yourself in conflict with or having a difficult time with, whether they're strangers or spouses or children or grandparents or in-laws or even people who are no longer here on this earth plane, if you can say to yourself, when I have this choice at any given moment to be right or to be kind, and I'm going to let my ego get out of this thing, and I'm going to choose to be at peace, as it says in the Course in Miracles, I can choose peace rather than this at any given moment. And then when you find yourself in these relationships with contentious people and you find yourself being able to be at peace when they push those buttons, you'll know that the reason that they showed up in your life in the first place is to teach you to honor your own worthiness. That's why you're with them. That's what they're there for. These are teachers, just like you are teachers to others. And you can let go of that ego-driven need to constantly be proving yourself and to make yourself right and to make more than making yourself right, to make them wrong, which is what we often do in this whole business of not honoring that. And it's like my wife and I made that agreement with each other that we would really work on it, because when you're in a long-term relationship and you've had a lot of children and you're together a lot, there are areas where she's on one path and I'm on another path, and she will say something and I'll find myself upset about it, and I'll say something, she'll find herself upset about it. Very often, I didn't even mean to do that. That wasn't my intention to upset her, but she just grabs a hold of it and takes it a certain way, or I will grab a hold of what she says and I'll twist it around inside and make something that will take me away from my peace. And we decided to make a commitment with each other to be more kind in our responses. And not only to do it with each other, and if we feel like we have to say something that puts them down or whatever, to just don't say anything. To just process it in a different way. And then to not only do it with them, but to do it with waitresses and stewardesses and baggage handlers and people on the freeway and, you know, strangers that you meet, to begin to send out and radiate out this kind of peace And if you want a model for that, of course, the great model for that are the spiritual masters. When Jesus Christ was being crucified and a soldier threw a spear into him, his response was forgive, forgive them. Because that's what came out was what was inside. So if you have that inside, you begin to shift to a more peaceful way of being. There are attitudes that each of us have that keep us from honoring our worthiness to receive. I'd like to give just five of them and talk a little bit about each one of them and see if we can shift out of them. The reason that you are honoring your worthiness to receive, remember, is because by not feeling worthy, you are entering into a negative space. That negative space blocks the free flow of what it is that you would like to have show up in your life. Whether it's money, love, prosperity, healing, whatever. You're saying, here I am here, over here, and to my right, I know what I want. I'd like to be able to manifest that. I'm practicing the meditation. I'm doing all the right things. But right in between what I want to manifest and what is out there for me to manifest is this huge obstacle. And that obstacle is, I don't feel that I deserve it. And the minute that you don't feel that you deserve it, as you think, so shall you be, you inhibit it from flowing into your life. This divine intelligence works like this. It will cooperate with you, but it will not cooperate with you if you feel that you're not worthy of its cooperation. So here are five attitudes that I believe that we need to cultivate. The first of these is, I am a human being expressing God without reservation. This is an attitude that says, who I am is particular, is individual, but I am expressing God. And therefore, I am honorable, I am worthy, I count, and I shouldn't be thinking of myself as something that is less than valuable. That's the first. The second is, I accept myself without complaint. I have a slogan that I use in my own life. It says, whenever I hear my children complaining or other people and they ask me for advice, I always say, don't complain, don't explain. Don't complain, don't explain. I accept myself without complaint. I look at the body that I'm in, and I understand that this is nothing more than my curriculum to God. There are things about it that if I were to be designing it myself, perhaps I would have done a little differently. I might have put a little extra hair on the top. I might have made myself a little taller. I might have made myself a little darker. I might have made my eyes a different color, whatever it is. But that isn't up to me. Because who I am is not this thing that I occupy. This is just a garage where I park my soul. And it doesn't matter. It is my curriculum to God. And whether it can see or can't see, whether it's in a wheelchair, whether it's 4'1" or 7'3", whether it's dark or white, whether it's living on the plains of the Kalahari, or whether it's living in New Guinea, or in Detroit, or Chicago, it doesn't make any difference. I accept myself without complaint. This is what I showed up in. And not only do I accept myself without complaint, but I accept life without complaining. And all of us have that choice, and we don't listen to that inner voice. That inner voice, I've often said that if prayer is you talking to God, then your intuition is God talking to you. And that intuition is something you want to listen to. And complaining about anything in your world, particularly about yourself, is a way of blocking the free flow of the divine intelligence that is everywhere and wants to be delivering abundance into your life. The third is, and this is a hard one for people, is I take full responsibility for my life. I take full responsibility for my life. You see, if you are disconnected or feel disconnected from the divine source, you cannot manifest. The separation is what keeps you from connecting. You can't align yourself. Not taking responsibility for your life and anything in it. And I get letters from people who feel that I shouldn't be saying this because people who have illnesses that they can't do anything about, they don't want to have to take responsibility for them. Or people who have been victims of abuse and things like this don't want to take responsibility for them. Taking responsibility doesn't mean that you feel guilty about anything that has come your way. It means that I have attracted this into my life in some way that I don't understand. It has showed up in my life. And it's my life. And I want to be able to ensure that these things don't show up anymore. And also, I want to be able to send them out of my life. But I can't do it if I don't assume a kind of responsibility for them. No guilt. And the fourth one is, I take on no guilt. If to feel worthy, you don't take on guilt. Just taking on this sense of responsibility. If I get anything in my body, that if it's a hernia, if it's an ache, if it's a pain, if it were a cancer, if it were arthritis, if it's I can't sleep, if it's a cold, if it's a backache, if it's a headache, whatever it is, I am going to say there's something in me that has attracted this. Rather than, I don't know how this happened, I'm just a victim. These kind of things happen, we live in a carcinogenic world, and these kind of things just happen. It's like the minute that you take responsibility for it, you connect to the divine source, which can heal it. The minute that you say, I had nothing to do with this, then you put that barrier up there, and you're disconnected from the healing of it. So I'm not talking, I want to reemphasize, I'm not talking about feeling guilty about it. I'm talking about saying, it's here, I've experienced it, I can do something with it. I can either go back to that stage of being an athlete and being a warrior and say, it's all in my ego, or I can do something profound about it, which is to say I can teach and become a statesman and a spiritual being by teaching others how to avoid having this happen. It came to me for a reason. I don't have to understand it. But I take responsibility for it. My dear friend Louise Hay had cancer. She was raped when she was a child. She had cancer of the cervix. Some 15 years later, saw a connection between the hostility and the anger that she had between the rape and this cancer that showed up and all of this anger that she had carried toward this event for, and said that when she was told she had the cancer, she took responsibility for it in that moment. She said, I carried that hatred and anger and bitterness around in that chakra of my body for that many years, and I am not going to carry it around any further. I'm not going to continue to be victimized. And that was the healing that took place for her, and she writes about it, and You Can Heal Your Life. No guilt, no abdicating the person who was responsible for it and saying, oh, it wasn't their fault. None of that. No removal of the punishment that the person deserved for that kind of conduct. None of that. Simply taking responsibility and saying, I now connect to whatever it is that's in my life, and I no longer am going to carry around the anguish and the guilt there, any place in my life. As soon as you do that, you honor your worthiness to receive the healing, to receive the abundance, to receive the love that might have been missing from your life. In A Course in Miracles, there are 483,364 words. How do you like that? I counted them. You talk about doing your homework, huh? 483,364 words in A Course in Miracles. That's almost 500,000 words. And the word beware appears once. One time. And here's what it says. Beware of the temptation to see yourself unfairly treated. Beware of the temptation to see yourself unfairly treated. It is a prescription for disaster, for guilt. The fifth and final affirmation or attitude to create for ourselves a sense of being worthy is to have congruency in your life. Congruency. I understand the importance of harmony between my thoughts, my feelings, and my behaviors. Very often, most of the problems that we face as people come from our inability to have congruency or harmony exist between what I think, what I feel, and how I behave. I may think one thing, I may feel something else, and then behave in a different way. And to have a congruency is to honor your worthiness. Virtually all addictions come from an incongruency. I have a thought about one thing, I feel something else, and then I behave in a different way. And that incongruency is what keeps us from feeling worthy. The final point I'd like to make on this feeling worthy and honoring your worthiness to receive is the need to unbond yourself from your wounds. If I stood up here and were to cut my hand, and then you were to look at my hand and just watch it, you would see that in a very short time, the wound would close up. If it stayed open, what would happen is that the disease process would set in. There would be sepsis or disease. There would be infection. And if I continued to keep it open by just pushing it open, making sure that it didn't close, I would eventually die. The organism couldn't live. Because the natural tendency of a wound is for it to close up and heal. Now, when we get into the spiritual dimension and the psychological dimension, what happens is that we get wounds from our childhood and from our past. We were only children. We were abused. We were abandoned. We had in-laws that were a certain way or parents that were a certain way. We had alcoholics for parents. We had to be put into orphanages. We were around drug addiction. We were poor. We were rich. Whatever it is, we have all of this stuff in our past. And what happens is that we bond to it. And we use these wounds of our past for attention. We use these wounds of our past for pity. And very often we lead with these wounds. So that when I introduce myself, it isn't very long before someone knows that I'm the child of an alcoholic. Or that I was an alcoholic myself. Or that I was abandoned or I was abused or whatever. And we keep hauling out these wounds. And one of the reasons we don't heal in our lives and we don't manifest in our lives is because we are attached to these things in our past. Rather than saying, whatever it is that happened to me, whatever lesson I had to learn from it, I got it. I've got the lesson. And now that I have the lesson, I no longer want to be attached to it and have that venom continue to pour through me and keep me from healing. So I let go of that. And most people whose lives are not filled with the things that they would like to see manifested for themselves are experiencing this because they're back there hanging on. How can you possibly talk to me when this is what happened to me when I was a child? How can you possibly say these things to me when don't you know what I've been through? You hear this, and if you don't do it with yourself, you do it with others. And if you don't do it with others, you do it with yourself. It's backwards and forwards all the time. And it comes from this sort of hallucination that we have that says, I and everybody else is entitled to a perfect pain-free childhood. And the fact is that whatever you needed to go through in your life in order to get the lessons of why you're here, you went through them. And all of those things, as you look back on them, you can either take them and say, they taught me how to be stronger. Or you can say, poor me, and lead with them. And keep opening that wound. And if you do, you'll eventually keep yourself from ever feeling worthy. So that's the third principle for manifestation. The idea that I am worthy, that I deserve it, that I am a divine child of God, that I have the proper attitudes in place to allow this free flow of energy into my life. Thank you. The fourth principle is realize that you are not separate from your environment. The affirmation for this is, I am one with my surroundings, aware of the connective energy between me and my world. I have talked a lot already about this need to remove the notion of our separateness. That's the invention of the ego. The ego needs to feel separate, otherwise it doesn't have any reason to be. So it constantly reinforces our separateness and our idea of being separate from everything. Well, one of the things that the ego, this idea we have of ourselves, has convinced us that we're separate from is the environment. And it's why we treat the environment the way we do. And you might be thinking, as you're listening to this, well, what's this got to do with manifesting? I mean, do I just have to join the Green Party and vote for Ralph Nader? I mean, what do I have to do? And it has nothing to do with that. Each of these principles throughout this entire program are really principles that are designed to get you to think of yourself in a new way. Because once you see yourself in this new light, the ability to do these things that you might have thought were not possible, that old idea that you can't do it begins to just gradually fade away. There's a word that's called a neologism, which is a term that defines, this defines a new word, neo, new logism, word, new logic. And the word that I coined is, don't think of yourself as an organism in an environment, think of yourself as an environ-organism. All one word, okay? Because literally that's what we are. And it's hard to shake this idea of being something that is in this world and separate from it, rather than being connected to all of it, because we can't see the connections. And so therefore we have a tendency to think of ourselves as separate. So let me try to bring it home. Let's say I want to describe walking across this room. So how can I describe walking across this room without describing what I am walking upon? Is it possible for me to give you a description of myself apart from my environment? In order to describe walking across this room, I have to describe not only walking, which is moving the legs forward, one after the other, but I also have to describe what I am walking upon. The carpet, the ground, the pebbles, whatever it might be. It's not possible for me to just talk about my legs moving. If I just talk about my legs moving, I'm not talking about walking, am I? So, in order to be able to walk, to describe walking, I must see myself as someone who is walking and someone who is walking upon something. Now, in addition to describing walking upon something, I must also describe what I am doing while I am walking. In order to be able to walk, I have to breathe, don't I? I can't describe walking across the room to someone who doesn't know what that is without describing my lungs inflating and deflating at every second. And what is it that is inflating and deflating? Why, it's the air. So I have to have air in order to describe walking across a room. So I have to be breathing. And what are all the other things that I have to describe as well? I can never, as long as I am in the physical plane, I can never describe myself without describing the environment that I am a part of. Now, what has this got to do with manifesting? If I am connected to my environment inextricably, I cannot be separated from my environment. The minute I do, I'm gone. I now enter that world that we call spirit, which has no environment, which is just everywhere at once. So in order to understand what manifesting is about, you have to understand that what you manifest or want to manifest is in the environment. And everything in the environment is also in you. You are already connected in the environment, in the physical world, to what it is you want to attract. And you can never separate yourself from it. It's like if you open up a book and look at the pages of the book and you say to somebody who's never read before or never seen a book, you try to describe what this is like. You say, what's there on the page? And you say, well, there's little letters. So are there just little letters? Little black letters? Little black pieces of ink? Little A's and B's and C's and D's? No, you can't describe the page of a book without describing the environment upon which the little black ink letters appear, can you? You need the background, don't you? You need the environment. You need the white page, the contrast, the opposite, the duality, in order to be able to describe reading. You have to have a background. Otherwise, you just got little letters floating around, and you can't read that. In order to see the stars at night, you have to have a black background in order to see them. Now, what I'm talking about here is really understanding the nature of the right-hand side of the room that I talked about earlier. When we're talking now about the right-hand side of the room, I'm talking about the physical plane. You have to understand the physical plane, your role in it, in order to escape it. And that's what this is about. It's about understanding the fundamental duality of your physical world and understanding that you are connected to it at all times. You can never separate yourself from it. The symbol for those who believe that we are in the environment in order to push it around is the bulldozer. The bulldozer is that instrument that we have devised that moves the earth around and cuts down the trees and destroys the forests and so on, not understanding that this is us. We are it. When we do too much of that, when we go to the extreme that we seem to be going to or could go to, then what happens is we are taking away the very thing that we need in order to sustain ourselves. If you take the air out, if you take that which gives us the nitrogen and the hydrogen and the oxygen, if you take that away, if you take the trees away, if you take the oceans and destroy the oceans and pollute the oceans, if you destroy all of the land, eventually what happens is you understand you cannot survive because you are connected to that. You have to have this. And there's only one air. There's only one fire. There's only one water. There's just little glasses of it. It's all one. And so seeing yourself as connected to the environment is one perspective, and seeing yourself as in the environment to push it around is another. Most of us have been raised on the idea that we're in the environment to push it around. And if we don't push it around, it will push us around. It will destroy us if we don't destroy it. And we don't get that when we are destroying it, we are destroying ourselves. And we are also destroying our ability to be able to bring to us, to attract to us, what it is that we would like in this way of manifesting when we see ourselves as separate from that which is in the world, the rest of the world. I'd like to take a look at the physical world, at the right-hand side of the room, and have you understand how it looks from a detached perspective. Have you ever seen a person with a front who doesn't have a back? Try to imagine such a thing. You know, a person with a nice front, and you turn around, and there's no back. Even if they're as anorexic as it gets, right? You still have a back, don't you? Can you imagine someone with an outside that doesn't have an inside? It's not possible, is it? In the physical plane, you always have the opposite. Now, the symbol for the physical plane is the sine wave, which has a crest, and then you go below the surface, and it has a trough, or a nadir and a valley, a top and a bottom. Now, this wave has its crest is always separate from its trough. You can see the top of a sine wave, that is the stuff that you're made up of. You can see the top of the wave, and you can see the bottom of a wave. But you can never just see the top. I used to teach metaphysics at the university, and I used to give an assignment to my class. I'd say, I want you to next week bring in a north pole of a magnet and no south pole. And people would go and they'd, you know, they'd slice it real thin. And then, but no matter how thin you slice that magnet, you always have its opposite, don't you? It's the nature of the physical plane to be in duality. When they talk about enlightened beings, they're talking very often, you'll hear it referred to in the literature, you'll hear these people referred to as non-dual beings. People who have gone past the duality of the physical plane. And this is a big part of what we're going to do here in this program, is learn how to do that. All right? But you have to understand it first, that at the top of the wave and at the bottom of the wave, you have that which is separate, but always together. Just like a back and a front. They're separate, but you can't have one without the other. Just like a top and a bottom. And then when you take it into other contexts, just like happiness and unhappiness. Just like light and dark. If it was always light, 24 hours a day, light. That was our reality. 24 hours a day, the light shines. Would we have a concept called darkness? We can only have a concept in the physical plane if we know its opposite. If it was always light, we wouldn't need a word like dark. It wouldn't exist. We wouldn't know such a thing. If everybody was always happy, would we have a concept called unhappiness? We wouldn't need any such thing, would we? If everybody's happy all the time, unhappiness wouldn't be something we talk about. Happiness and unhappiness go together. They're partners. Haven't you noticed in your life that when things are going really, really well, generally speaking, there's some caca on its way? Hasn't that generally been the case? I mean, if you're, it's like, isn't life hills and valleys in the physical plane? There's ups, there's the, you know. And the good news is, when you're in the caca, there's a hill coming. It's the only direction you can go. You kind of, that's always been, it's this idea of always being happy 24 hours a day, all the time. It's like trying to find light 24 hours a day. The other thing, of course, is life and death. You know, we often have this idea that life and death are enemies to each other. The top of the wave, the bottom of the wave. Everything that has ever died must have what? Must have lived. You can't have death without life. And the reverse is always true. Every top has a bottom. Every inside has an outside. Every front has a back. Everyone who has ever lived also must have died. Death and life are partners. They're not enemies. We've gotten this idea that they're enemies, and we have books about how to slay it, and we worry about it, and it's this tremendous anxiety that we live with over whether we're going to live and when, how long we're going to live, and death is something that shouldn't happen. But death is just, the physical plane is life and death. Everything comes into the physical plane. It's quiet dust. Emily Dickinson had this wonderful poem. She said, "This quiet dust was gentlemen and ladies and lads and girls, was laughter and ability and sighing and frocks and curls." So simple. All this dust that you see, you hold it up in your hand. What was it before? This quiet dust. Gentlemen and ladies. All of us. And so, what I'd like you to do now is to think of something in the physical plane that could never experience darkness. It's impossible for this to ever experience darkness. Couldn't happen. No matter how hard you tried, you could not have this thing experience darkness. And that would be the sun. Why is it that the sun could never experience darkness? Because the sun is the source of all light. Right? So there's an aha in here. There's a eureka. There's a, oh, I see. In order to be able to transcend the duality of the physical plane, you must go to your source. When you go to the source, that is that which is the cause of, you transcend the physical plane. And when you do, you create whatever it is you want to in the physical plane from the position of the source. You go out into the springtime or in the fall, you look at all of those magnificent colors out there, the reds and the blues and the oranges and the greens and the yellows, all of these fantastic colors of flowers and leaves and so on. And you ask yourself, what is the source of all of this color? And there's only one source of all color. It's called light. Light is the source of all color. Without light, there's no color. But there are many individualized expressions of that one source. You similarly have an essence. We are all individualized expressions of one essence, just like every flower and every color on every leaf is the same. An individualized expression of one light. We are an individualized expression of one essence. Now, what you call this essence isn't what it is anyway. We get nervous about it, and we fight wars over that, and we kill each other over what you call it. So if you want to call it God or soul or spirit or Kantenfloss or Louise, it doesn't make any difference what you call it. It's not what you call it. It just is. Call it the Tao. Call it God. Call it soul. Call it spirit. I don't care what you call it. But come to know it. When you go to your source. Now, when people are learning to become sorcerers, they're even told, you will become a sorcerer. And we hear the word sorcerer, right away we think of witches, don't we? And witchcraft and sorcery. But the origin of the word source means, sorcerer means of the source. People who are of the source, who have gone to their source. When you go to your source, and how do you get to your source? Melville said that God's one and only voice is silence. Silence is your source. Silence is like the number zero. When you go to zero, you can't subtract anymore. Nor can you divide, can you? You can't divide zero. You just keep dividing it and dividing it, and you just keep coming up with zero. The same is true of silence. There's only one silence. You don't get your own silence, and I get a silence, and you get a silence, any more than you get your own fire, and I get a separate fire, and you get a separate water, and you get separate water, and you get separate air, and I get separate air. There's just air. And there's just water. Different individualized expressions of it. We call it the Pacific, and we call it the Atlantic, and the St. Clair River, and Lake Superior, and all of these kinds of things. But it's just water. There's only one. The same thing is true of silence. The same thing is true of God. The same thing is true of your divine intelligence, whatever you want to call it. When you go to that source, that place that cannot be further divided, you now enter into the world of creation. You don't create because everything is already here. You enter the world of manifestation, the world of creation. And in this world, you become a co-creator. That is, not creation from the sense of bringing something from nowhere to here, but creation from the sense of attracting into your life and creating into your life that which has been missing. In order to further understand this, you have to think of like how you think you get here in the first place. We have this funny idea. This idea that you can divide the room, you know, on the right-hand side is the physical and on the left-hand side is the spiritual. But before you send me any mail, I know that it's all one. I'm just doing this because I happen to still be in the physical plane. And we need duality in order to understand from the perspective of the ego. But my inner knowing is that there's no separation of spirit and matter. That God is in all things. And that there is individualized expressions of it. But that this intelligence doesn't ever particularize. It can't. That would mean that there's some place that it isn't the minute that it particularizes. And if it's universal, there can never be any place that it isn't. That's what universal means. One verse. So we have this myth that we live under that says we come into this world. And we really sort of think of ourselves as like a construction project. You know, like there's the spirit world. And we divide it up into befores and afters. So I'm here, but before I was here, I was nowhere. And then I went from nowhere, N-O-W-H-E-R-E, to now here, N-O-W-H-E-R-E, just a little different spacing. And now I'm in now here, and I look around, and after a while I have this thundering realization that I'm going back to nowhere, and then it's all the same. But somehow our intellect, our left brain, tells us we come from a spirit world, and then we come into this physical world, and then when we leave it and we die, we go back to a spirit world. Isn't that what we think? It's not like that at all. We have to shatter that myth. Here's the way to think of it. It's like, think of a plum tree. Plum tree has very interesting characteristics of it. Again, you go back to the seed, you know the seed inside of a plum. Is there plum essence in a plum seed? Is the essence of plumness in a plum seed? Has to be, doesn't it? So you put the seed into the ground and you plant it, and all of a sudden it starts breaking open and roots develop and they go under the ground. Is there plum essence in the roots? Isn't there? There has to be, doesn't there? Something in there is going to create plums. And then those roots grow and spread, and all of a sudden a tree starts sprouting up above the surface. And there's a trunk. Is there plum essence in the trunk? Yeah. And then the trunk gets higher, and there are branches. And then the branches develop leaves. And then the leaves develop blossoms. And then the blossoms develop little buds. And then the little buds turn into little tiny plums. And then you let them stay on there for a while, and then they turn into purple plums or green plums or whatever their essence is. Now, we don't say, when we observe this phenomenon, that these plums showed up from the spirit essence world of plumness. Do we? We don't do that. We just look at the tree, and we observe it, and we watch the whole thing, and we realize that plum essence is in all of the things, and we stand back and we watch it, and we say, you know, the damn thing just plums. It just plums, like an apple tree. It just apples. So too are we like this. We are not separate from that spirit world. That separation is the thing we got to get out of us. It's like someone could come back and look at the whole planet and say there's vegetation, there's rocks, there's minerals, there's rain, there's sunshine. Look at this thing from a distance. Look at it. Just watch it. And what happens? You watch it and you watch it and you watch it, and the damn thing just peoples. It just peoples. That's the way Alan Watts put it. It just simply peoples. We don't come into this world. We grow out of this world. We are a part of all of it, and we can never escape it. And once you know this, once you get this, that you weren't placed in here from this spirit world any more than plums were, or apples, or cockroaches, or anything. We are all in this thing called the environment together. And this divineness, this spirituality, this higher consciousness is a part of all of it. And we have to know that rather than separating it out. This world, that world, this world. Because our senses tell us that before you're here, you're nowhere. And after you leave here, you're gone. But our senses are not reliable at all. They misguide us all the time. They tell us that we're sitting here right now. And they say, you're sitting there still. You're not moving. That's what our senses tell us, don't we? We don't think we're moving. You think you're spinning right now? But yet you are, aren't you? Aren't we turning and spinning and hurling through space and all of that. Our senses tell us all of this stuff. It's not true. So we don't want to rely upon our senses. That's the intellect. We want to rely upon our heart and have this knowing that my essence is in every single aspect of myself. And that in order to transcend the prison of the duality of the physical plane, I go to my source. And when I go to my source, I get quiet, the place where I cannot further be divided. You see, our egos divide us up. We divide ourselves up by our races, by our sexes, by our age, by our appearances, by our economic class, by our languages. And then we divide ourselves up further within the country, by our communities, by our cities, by our states. And we divide ourselves further by our schools and our religious orientations and our food preferences and the shape of our eyes. And then we divide our individual selves up on the basis of what my mother thinks of me and what my father thinks of me and what I used to be and what I ought to be and what I maybe could become, but I can't because. And we keep dividing ourselves and dividing ourselves and dividing ourselves. That's the work of the ego. What we want to do is come up with a new symbol. Get rid of the bulldozer and come up with a new symbol. It's called a hologram. I have a definition of a hologram. A hologram is a three-dimensional photographic image obtained with laser beams. A three-dimensional photographic image obtained with laser beams. The essence of a hologram, you have them on your Visa cards and MasterCards and American Express. Let's give them all their own plug. A hologram, the interesting thing about a hologram is that you take one tiny little sliver off of an object and you project a laser beam through it and it projects what? The whole, doesn't it? It projects the whole thing. You take just one little tiny slice of it, like that, and you put this laser beam through it, and you look at it, and in every tiny infinitesimal piece of a hologram, the whole becomes projected with a laser beam. That's what a hologram is. Every individual part contains the whole. Now, what an interesting notion that is. Think of humanity as like a 6 billion piece hologram. And we take one piece out, and we put a laser beam through it, and we see all of humanity. That's what manifesting is like. You have to be able to see yourself as an individualized expression of the whole, of it all, and not see yourself as separate from anything in this environment. Now you start thinking about that thing I asked you to think about what would you like to manifest. And you realize that it is part of the hologram as well. Everything on the planet is part of the hologram. Now what you do is you say to yourself from your source, from your quiet space, the place that can't be further divided. You can't divide silence. You can't divide God. Gandhi said, in heaven there is no religion. Thank God. You can't divide spirituality. You can't organize spirituality. You can't divide any of this. You go to the source. When you go to the source, you go to zero. And from the perspective of the source, you look out on the physical plane and you put your attention on what it is that you would want to manifest, knowing that you are not separate from it, never have been, never could be. Even from the moment of your conception to the moment of your death, your life is not like this temporary experience between two eternal blacknesses. It's just like a parenthesis in eternity. But it doesn't begin here and end here. It is always. And so is everything in your environment. Just try detaching yourself from something in your environment. Just try describing yourself. Just try being for a moment separate from your environment. As a physical being, you can't do it. You need the air. You need the ground you walk on. You need the gravity that holds you down. But go to your source. And from the position of the source, you create all the light, as the sun does. Indeed, you're not an organism in an environment. You are an organism-environment, or an environ-no-organism.